This is Tom Sycast. I just recently turned 50. I know. 50. So a biologist looks at 50. And as I've turned 50, I've started to think about my life and how did I end up where I'm at today. And I'm pretty happy where I'm at. I'm a lecturer, a principal lecturer at the University of New Mexico, where I teach a variety of courses, including, as some of you know, astrobiology. And I also teach ecology, evolution, some plant and animal physiology, cell and molecular biology, and a few intro classes. Now, how did I get here? What are my life experiences? So as a biologist who looks at 50, I got that from a Jimmy Buffett song, A Pirate Looks at 40, I'm kind of looking back on my life. And I thought it'd be fun, at least for me, to kind of go over my life. Just like, where have I been? How did I get here? Why am I like this? And it's been quite the ride. And I can go all the way back to my early childhood. You know, when I was little, in the late 70s, gosh, I know, late 70s, early 80s, I wanted to catch lizards all the time. And we had anoles, Anolis carolinensis, or the Carolina anole, around our house in Tallahassee. And they were fun to catch. So I would wake up in the morning ready to go catch those lizards. And if I was lucky, I could go out to my grandparents' house and they had some skinks out there. And if I got really lucky, I could go catch me a fin swift at my friend's house who lived out of town. I've later learned those are in the genus Calopterus. But that was me as a little kid. I was like, basically from the get-go, I was out catching lizards and interested in biology. I'm sure my dad and granddad had something to do with that. They were also from North Florida, and in fact, I'm sixth generation Wakulla County. So I was born right south of Tallahassee and grew up near the coast in North Florida, the Panhandle, where my family had been since the 1820s. Now, my grandfather and my dad, they liked to go hunting and fishing. So in the summertime, we would go fishing. In the fall and winter, we went hunting. In the spring, we waited for everything to warm up to go fishing again. Oh, wait, isn't there an Austin Powers joke in there somewhere as well? I know, I'm influenced by pop culture. I can't help myself. But during my childhood, these formative years, I spent a lot of time outdoors. And I loved animals and just learning everything. And my grandfather, he didn't have a high school education, actually. He didn't even finish high school. But he knew natural history. So we were going out hunting, and he would point up to those little Tweety birds floating around the tops of the trees, and he's like, those are ruby-crowned kinglets. And then we would go down to the St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge, one of my favorite birding spots in the entire world, and they could name off all the ducks and most of the large birds that we would see. And he didn't even own a bird book. And then he knew the flowers as well. So I was influenced very early on by my granddad, who was a pretty good naturalist. And, you know, I even remember telling my dad one day when I was a kid, like, maybe one day I'll know as much as Papa. And Dad goes, that would be pretty amazing, son. So as you can see, I started out very early on the biology track. But at the same time, interestingly, I also fell in love with astronomy. And in fact, one of the earliest documentaries I can remember watching was Carl Sagan's Cosmos on PBS. And in fact, whenever I'd go to the library at my school, I was checking out astronomy books, not biology books. I know, isn't that weird? I liked animals and I liked identifying them and knowing them and catching them. But astronomy is what I was reading about. So the very first type of scientist I wanted to be was an astronomer. But I got talked out of that later on as I went on, and I had this interest in animals as well. And in fact, in the seventh grade, you know, circa 1986, I was in Boy Scouts, and we were camping up at Colomoki Mounds in southern Georgia, and I bought my first bird book, a Golden Guide. And I chose it over the Peterson Guide for the simple fact that it had the range maps right next to the species write-up. So I started studying birds in the seventh grade. Little did I know that my seventh grade PE teacher was an avid birder, and I told him one time in class, I found out he liked birds, and I was like, I like birds. and he thought that the other teachers were pranking him by getting me to go up and say I like it. Years later, I run into him still down in the refuge, and we talk birding. If only I knew, right? I didn't know that birding was really a thing in the 80s. Okay, jump ahead to high school. In high school, I was bound to go be a wildlife biologist. But I still loved astronomy, kind of more as a hobby. And not so much with telescopes. I was very interested in galaxies and quasars and things like that. But in high school, I took a chemistry class, and turns out we all have our superpowers, right? I don't know where this came from, but I ended up liking chemistry. I know, some of you are shifting in your chairs going, chemistry, yuck. In fact, my wife hates organic chemistry. But my teacher at the end of the year gave some chemistry final exam, and it was some licensing exam. I don't even remember what it was. And I aced it, and the next highest grade was like a 60. And he's like, Tom, you might want to consider a career in chemistry. Now, this wasn't out of the blue. My parents, every year, would meet with a group of friends, and they tailgated at a friend's house to go to all the football games. And my parents had been going to the football games with Joe Schmidt, who unfortunately recently just passed away right before I turned 50. And Joe Schmidt had a PhD in organic chemistry from Florida State, and his major advisor, his PhD advisor, mentor, was Dr. Werner Hertz. He was German, and they would come and hang out with us, and we'd go to the football games together. So very early on, I had, you know, these two organic chemists telling me, you know, encouraging me to go into chemistry. And they're like, yeah, you should definitely go into college and go into chemistry. And I had been told that biology doesn't make good careers, but a chemistry degree, you're golden. So I actually started out chemical engineering, and I got all the way to my junior year, right? And I took like the four semesters of calculus and, oh gosh, physics one and two, and with calc-based physics and what else? Oh, thermo and transport and biochem. Actually, I ended up dropping a couple of those classes in my junior year because I was looking at my chemistry classes that I had to take, and I really didn't like them. They were incredibly math heavy. And then I would walk over. I had some friends that I met at the gym that were in the biology department. And I remember going over to Conradi at Florida State and going, wow, I want to take that class, that class, that class, and that class. So I dropped a few of these engineering classes that I didn't need that were really, they were hard. I'm not going to lie. They were hard. They were quite challenging. So I dropped those chemistry classes, like biochem, or thermo. I can't remember which one I completed. It's been 30 years, right? 1995, so 29 years. And I switched my major to biology, and I went home and told my dad, and he got really mad at me. He's like, damn it, son, what are you doing? A biology degree and a dime will get you a cup of coffee, right? And I was like, well, yeah, I know, but I really, really like biology. And that first year in biology was it was easy at first, because the first two classes I took were like ridiculously easy because I'd already had all the physics and chemistry needed. So I wasn't just a freshman taking my first bio class. I'd already learned a lot of what I knew. So it was easy. And then all of a sudden, I got into the fall of 1995, which is one of the most important semesters and time periods of my life. Because at the time, I was taking ecology with Dan Simberloff, and I had marine biology, and I had a botany class, and I think a genetics class. That's the one, these four science classes. I had to kind of play catch up in my bio degree here because I was already technically a senior that year. I was supposed to graduate in 96, but I did not. Well, at any rate, the reason why I had switched in the fall or in the spring of 94. No, wait. Yeah, I dropped my classes in the fall of 94. By spring of 95, I was taking these biology classes, biology one and two, and they were not that hard. But in the fall, that ecology class with Dan Simberloff kicked my butt. I probably shouldn't admit that I made a C in that class. I had a B going into the final, but I took four finals, three on Monday, one on Tuesday, and I had three A's and one B. I came out with one A two B's and a C. And my C, of course, was ecology, which I have my PhD in, ironically. But that was interesting because that was the first time in biology. I was really challenged and really liked it. But I also met two of my lifelong friends, Howard Horn, who I definitely do not talk to enough, and Michael Collins. And I also met my other friend, Bart Kickleiter. Here we are, 30 years later, 29, sorry. And we are still friends. I talk to them, or at least we have texting messages going back every few weeks or so. And I actually lived with Bart for a while. So I met some of my best friends at that time. And then Michael Collins, who is my ecology TA, said, hey, take higher vertebrates with Fran James. And I had heard the name Fran James, something about her studying red-cockaded woodpeckers. And me being a birder, I knew they were hard to find and endangered. So I took higher vertebrates with her, and Michael was my TA for the second semester. And by this time, we were actually becoming pretty good buddies because we had a lot in common, especially we liked to go birding. And then that spring of 96, you know, I discovered spring migration. Oh my goodness, that was really fun. But I got to know Fran James, and she realized that I was from Wakulla, which is where a lot of her study sites were, and that I knew the area very, very well. So she, that summer, I took another class with her called Conservation Biology, which to this day, a lot of my views on conservation biology actually came out of that class that I took with her in 1996. It was that formative, right? But then I started working with Bart. He became a graduate student of hers and another guy named Eric Walters. And basically, I started studying red-cockaded woodpeckers. And my job was, well, back in those days, I was powerlifting. So I'd carry the ladders out to the trees and we would stack the ladders and go up the trees and score the RCW holes. So we would go throughout the entire Apalachicola National Forest. And we would climb those holes at night to see who was using them and who was in there, who was not. And we discovered that lots of other things used those woodpecker holes besides red-cockaded woodpeckers. But this was my first start in science. And so I really thank Fran James for giving this kind of unknown, doing okay, you know, college undergraduate, a place in her lab to go do collect data for them, for her graduate students and herself. So in addition to doing all of the tree climbing, I also did lots of veg work, and I learned a lot of the vegetation from Howard Horn, Howard is probably the best naturalist I have ever met. And I've been in biology since 1995, doing biology. And he knows plants, he knows birds, he learns a taxon so quickly. It's amazing. His brain just works so different than the rest of us. And it's a beautiful mind to see it turning, to see him learn butterflies in basically a weekend. There are a few people that can do that. Me, to learn the plants, Howard, what is this plant? What is this plant? What is this plant, right? So I'm having to learn all of these plants as we're doing our veg work. So not only did I learn how to do veg work, not only did I learn how to climb trees and score woodpecker holes, I was also learning about how we do science. Because part of her project was studying this the red-cockaded woodpecker. It turned out that there were two major populations on the Apalachicola National Forest. There were two districts separated by the Oclocany River. And on the Wakulla district, the RCWs, red-cockaded woodpecker, were declining. But on the Oclocany side, the Liberty side, which is Liberty County, they were staying steady. And it turns out that she wanted to know why. So she took this manipulated experiment of about 300,000 acres and did fire, some in the summer or the growing season, some in the winter or the non-growing season, and others, 100,000 acres of that would have been alternating between growing and non-growing season. And she, along with some others, discovered that the time of year, the timing of the fire really mattered for the RCWs, which is, we didn't think that at the time, but basically, if you did a non-growing season burn, think like January when those guys like to go out and burn, that promoted palmettos, And if you did a growing season burn like May and June, which is a summertime burn, that promoted a lot more forbs and flowers. And that actually affected the populations of these red-cockaded woodpeckers big time. So I got to be a part of that experiment with her. Well, you know, you start meeting people and people start getting connected, right? So interestingly, Eric Walters at the time had just come from Arizona. He was actually Canadian. And he worked for Tom Martin, who had a study site in northern Arizona. Now, ironically, and the, not ironically, but in the, what was it? Oh, yeah, it was December 96, January 97. I actually went with Michael back to Arizona to go stay with his family for Christmas. It was my first time to Arizona. We birded like crazy, went all through the Rio Grande Valley. And I fell in love with Arizona. And we went up to the Grand Canyon and Flagstaff. But that year, Eric Walter says, hey, what are you doing when you graduate? Yeah, it took me 5 years to graduate. Why don't you go work for Tom Martin? They need guys to go up there to score the birds, the cavity nesting birds. So yeah, I graduate from college in May of 97 after 5 years. And I just get in my truck and I drive from Florida out to Arizona to the Coconino National Forest near what's called the Mogollon Rim. And man, I get there. I'm from Florida, right? You know, May is, we're already getting into the 90s, right? But I get there and it's like in the springtime for me, but it's like 25 degrees at night, high of 45 and 8,000 feet. And I had just come from like 0 feet, right? So I was sucking wind and freezing my butt off, but I loved it. And I lived in a tent from like all of May, all of June, and most of July. I lived in a tent in a clearing. And in fact, I spent many of my days just sleeping out underneath the stars. There's that astronomy. And in fact, Comet Hale-Bopp was actually, was that right? Comet? Yeah, I think Hale-Bopp was visible for much of the summer. And it was a big comet too. But while I was living in Arizona, working for Tom Martin, and it was a big crew. There was like 20 to 30 people, graduate students, postdocs coming in, going out, lots of us field workers that had just gotten a degree or were, you know, juniors and seniors. We were out there working and they were finding like every bird nest you could imagine. So you had people going out just to find bird nests. And I worked with a guy named Mike Francis. And what we did is we carried ladders all around and we would climb the trees and we would score the trees to see how many eggs they had. We would take information on how high the hole was and what direction it was facing and what kind of tree it was. And oh my gosh, one time we stacked 7 10-foot ladders up an aspen tree. And yes, I was 70 feet up an aspen tree once. That was my record, was 7 ladders. It took me like 30 minutes to get all of those up there because I could only carry like 4 at a time, right? So I had to go up and down, up and down, up and down. And that experience was amazing. I mean, I knew at that point that I was going to go into biology. I was interested in conservation, maybe even doing birds. But, you know, you graduate, you don't immediately start graduate school. Things happen, right? So I come back. I didn't acquire a job after that one. So it ended, and I just kind of traveled around for a little bit. And my dad goes, hey, son, why don't you come on home, get your job back in Tallahassee? And I honestly felt really defeated because I didn't want to go back home. I wanted to just work field jobs for an indefinite amount of time, seeing the country, doing cool field work, and then eventually go on to graduate school at some point. But I didn't have a plan. So, but it turned out okay. So I ended up coming back to Tallahassee, and I had gotten this award in Boy Scouts called the William T. Hornaday Award. And it turns out that the director of Tall Timbers Research Station was a lifelong friend of my dad's. They went back all the way to elementary school. And he presented me the award a few years earlier. And he told me in like 1994, hey, Tom, if you ever need a job, come talk to me. Well, guess what? I needed a job. And sure enough, he got me a job up there at Tall Timbers Research Station. Now, this was a fun job, right? So Tall Timbers is in North Florida, just north of Tallahassee. And they are really big in forest or fire ecology and quail restoration. So if you don't know this about the Southeast, prior to about the 1860s or so, before the Civil War, or before there was a lot of people down there, there were about 70 million acres of longleaf pine forest. And today there's about 1,500 acres of virgin longleaf pine forest left. It's one of the rarest forest ecosystems in the world. And part of the red-cockaded woodpeckers is, guess what? They live in fire-dependent ecosystems dominated by longleaf pine forest. Well, quail, turns out, also live in kind of patchy habitats that require fire. Or at least the northern bobwhites do. And if you get it all overgrown, you lose the quail. So Tall Timbers was studying a lot of like how you manage land to get quail. Now that seems a little, you know, myopic to only focus on one species, but the reality is if you have a lot of quail, northern bobwhites, sorry, my Florida redneckness is coming out, but if you have a lot of quail coming in, you get everything back, right? You restore that habitat. So one of the things that I did is we had radio collars on these quail, put out these traps, and I caught and banded about 75 quail, and we put these radio trackers on them. And I used radio telemetry, riding around in a four-wheeler through the woods, tracking quail and recording their locations. And then we would also do call counts where we'd figure out where they are in the morning. And then in the springtime, we did fire. So I was heavily involved with setting those woods on fire for part of management and restoration. And in fact, at the time I was there, they were doing a really big hardwood cut to try to restore more of the longleaf pines to improve the quail populations. So that was really fun. That was a really good job. And I could have probably ended up staying there for the rest of my career. It could have been possible for me to have done that. But there's this nagging thing, right? Like part of the problem of moving back to Tallahassee is I was plugged back with all my old friends, and Tall Timbers was far away. I lived far away and I felt kind of isolated. And it's kind of weird, even though I was close by, but that place, you know, it became very insular. Not in a bad way. It's just I was away from my world of what I had established in my previous years at Florida State in the previous 5 years. So I ended up leaving that job and had some roundabout things that happened. Don't need to really go into those here, but you know how things go in life. But I ended up later on working at Wakulla Springs State Park. I went back initially to drive boats because during undergraduate, I was driving boats, glass bottom boats and riverboat tours, pointing out alligators to tourists, right? So I had a good rapport there, and that was right near my house in Wakulla. And, you know, there was a part of me like, I knew I came back to Tallahassee. Sure enough, I wanted to be south back in Wakulla. So I ended up working at Wakulla Springs State Park. And then after the end of the summer, the park biologist, a man named Scott Savory, kept saying, yeah, you need to come work for me as the invasive plant specialist. And I'm like, no, I don't want that job. I don't want that job. Then he finally talked me into it. And ironically, at the same time, because the boat driving position was OPS, I got this offer to work for Scott as this invasive plant specialist, because hydrilla, this aquatic plant, had basically just exploded in the Wakulla River. I mean, it went from this beautiful eelgrass to just covered in hydrilla. And I mean, I've never seen an invasive species take over that fast. And now, interestingly, because that was not a permanent position with the state, I was maybe thinking about getting on with a little bit more bigger salary. So I went and interviewed with the Florida Rails to Trails, and they actually offered me a permanent job with the Department of Environmental Protection. And I'm like, wow, a permanent job with DEP. That's great. And despite the fact that I'm being offered a permanent position, I turned it down to work with Scott Savory at Wakulla Springs because I started to realize a couple things about work and what I wanted. And I knew that I wanted to work with somebody who was really cool. And I really like Scott. Not that those other people weren't cool, but I really liked working for Scott. And I really knew what that job entailed. And of course, it was at one of my most favorite places in the world, Wakulla Springs. And in fact, the Wakulla River is my favorite river in the world. Comes out of the ground out of a large spring with crystal clear water some of the time, going through, you know, these ancient cypress swamps. It's just gorgeous. It's loaded with alligators and turtles and all kinds of wildlife. I just love that river so much. And to work on that, to start restoring something that I loved, I knew that was where I wanted to be. And at the same time, I was also keeping in really close touch. My friends were all graduate students in the biology department at Florida State. And so, you know, they're like, hey, have you thought about doing any experiments with this? Oh, Tom, by the way, you should go to graduate school. Right? You should go to graduate school. And I was like, yeah, I never took the GRE. I don't know. But this time I'm getting about, you know, several years out. But I was like thinking about it, but I hadn't quite applied yet. So come around early 2000, I gave a tour to some people that were earning their master's in nature conservation or something. I forget, one of those citizen science classes. And this guy starts talking to me, and I had seen him around birding and doing other things. And his name was Harry Hooper, and he worked for a consulting firm, a rather big one. And he saw what I was doing at the park, and he goes, we could really use your help. You would make a lot of money. And I was like, well, as OPS, you know, when the grant ran out, I might be out of a job again. This large consulting firm, Harding ESC, a MacTech corporation, is offering me this job, right? So I took it. I went into environmental consulting around April of 2000. And it was hard because when I was at Wakulla Springs, I was the invasive aquatic specialist. And I actually wrote the management plan, the first management plan for invasive species in a state park in Florida. It was with Scott. It was really cool to do that. And they paid for me to get certified diving, which I picked up that hobby and I really, really loved it. But being the consultant, I now had more money and my boss was really cool. So I was going all over the state of Florida doing site assessments. Because what the state was doing back in the early 2000s, late 90s, they were buying up land for state forests, for state parks. It was all part of the Carl and Preservation 2000. So I got to go all over Florida to the most pristine lands that the state was buying and do site assessments. I mean, I flew over most of Fakahatchee Strand in South Florida in a helicopter. How cool is that? And my boss, Kathy Hodak, she was awesome. And she was also a fellow diver. So she would be like, hey, Tom, we got these sites down in the Florida Keys. They're up there near Key Largo. They're in the Northern Keys. And then you've got some up there in the Lower Keys or Matacumbe. Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. I booked your flight from Wednesday through Sunday. Just please pick up the car on Saturday and Sunday in the hotel room on Monday because you'll be done on Thursday and you can go diving. And that's what I did. I one of the little perks of the job is I had the plane ticket. She would book me the plane ticket for an extended weekend knowing that's what I wanted. And I would just pick up a hotel room one night and I'd have a couple days of diving. It was spectacular. So that was awesome. And that was that job. And I worked really hard on that job. And it was really rewarding to go all over the state looking at all these pristine lands. Now, ironically, what this company's bread and butter was doing remediation on groundwater contamination. So I got to also learn about how a lot of gas stations leak and how you fix that, which was interesting. So I got to do a lot of like the groundwater remediation as well. Well, at any rate, that goes from 2000, like the spring of 2000, and then 2000, that fall rolls around. And I've got a friend, and they're going up to University of Virginia. And they're like, hey, I'm going to go to University of Virginia. I'm going to get a postdoc in the biology department. You should come up there with me. And I was like, no. I'm good here. No, you should go. I've got a friend that's looking for graduate students. He's really cool. His name is Dave Carr. Okay. All right, so I went up to UVA and I checked it out. This is University of Virginia now, and I'm sitting there going, I'm not worthy, man. Like University of Virginia, that's a really good school. And I discovered birding and spring migrations and undergraduates, so my GPA was a little lower than it needed to be. I still maintained above 3.2. So at any rate, I was like, man, I didn't take the GRE. I'd been out of school for almost 4 years now. But I studied, and I did okay. I did good enough on the GRE to get accepted. And I went up to Virginia with my friend to check out the town. I drove up to see Dave Carr at the Blandy Experimental Research Station and really liked him. Also a birder. And he was studying other things and plants. And then he also was like interested in invasive species as well, because I had kept up my relations at Wakulla Springs. And I was still good friends with Scott. We were still talking about hydrilla, and realized that I could get a master's studying why hydrilla exploded at Wakulla Springs. Why did it take over the park so quickly, or the river in the park so quickly? Well, that was pretty scary, quitting a good full-time consulting job to go to graduate school. So here we are, fall 2001. I move all the way up to UVA, and I'm going to start graduate school. I drove up to Maine to go birding before that and did some of the coast, and then I started graduate school. And let me tell you, when I started graduate school at UVA, I started with 20 other students, and I will tell you, that is one of the largest groups, an inordinate number of uncommonly cool people. They were awesome. I had this instantaneous group that, hey, what are you doing tonight? I don't know. Let's go have a beer. 15 people would show up. Hey, it's my birthday today. 20 people would show up. Hey, it's springtime. It's above 60 degrees. Let's go have a margarita. 15 people would show up at your house. Just an amazingly tight group of people. And the department encouraged that. We had the annual pig roast in the fall. We had a big Christmas party. And then we had the spring fling where, you know, we all dress up and the girls would break out their old prom dresses and have a big dance. And we would end all of the parties with Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire. So this was like a time in my life when I worked so hard. I was a TA for the first time. I was taking some pretty hard classes in graduate school, developing my master's thesis. And my master's thesis, I really thank Dave Carr for really helping me out here with the experimental design of manipulating nutrient levels in the water to see how that would affect the growth of hydrilla. So in the summertime, I moved out of Charlottesville and went up to the experimental station, and that's where I stayed for the entire summer with all the REUs. And that was just such an incredible experience up there. We would do all the fun stuff. We'd go birding, we'd go hiking, we did some canoeing and kayaking on the rivers up there, and they're just gorgeous rivers. And we would go out at sunset, and one of my favorite memories is watching tens of thousands of fireflies wake up in the grasses and just kind of move slowly up higher and higher and higher as it got to be more and more dusk, while listening to the whippoorwills call in the background. Yes, if I'm painting a fantastical picture, it's because it was. And during those summers, I worked hard. You know, I had 24 of these mesocosms, which are independent experimental units. So they were these large 1,000-liter cattle tanks that I filled every one of them with sand. And then I had to go and get permits from Florida to basically bring hydrilla back up to Virginia and collect some, you know, fish and snails and things like that. So I was looking at the entire community, but mostly interested in the hydrilla. So I had to get through all the permits and everything to get that done. And it was backbreaking work to fill, you know, 24 of these tanks with, you know, sand about a half a foot deep. And then I manipulated the nitrate levels throughout the summer. And then at the end of the summer, I looked at the amount of growth of the hydrilla and the native plants. And the control experiment, which was no nutrients added, I actually had to lower the nutrient levels and then check their growth. And then the other ones, I raised it to like 1 gram per liter or something like that. I forget the exact measurements. It's hard to believe it's been 23 years since I've done that. But at any rate, after 2 summers of doing these experiments, it was quite clear that native plants, and native eelgrasses, the Sagittaria curtiana and Vallisneria americana, you can double, triple, quadruple the amount of nitrates in the water. Doesn't affect their growth at all. However, Hydrilla was a different story. You add nutrients to the water and hydrilla grows even faster. And when we look at the Wakulla River, during the 1990s, it went from a very low nutrient ecosystem to almost a 5 or 10-fold increase in the nutrient levels, specifically nitrates. And that, we think, fueled the boom in hydrilla growth. It was just able to outcompete the native plants completely. And that's one of the things we discovered in my master's thesis. All right, so that was really fun. I mean, my master's at University of Virginia was just one of the hardest moments I've ever worked in my life. I was intellectually challenged. I made incredibly good friends. And I look back at that. I don't want to say it was the most fun I ever had, because I don't know what the most fun I ever had. But it was definitely a very formative and excellent time in my life. And I kept going back to Florida. And on the way to Florida, I'd stop and see Michael Collins. And then Bart would join us. And Bart would come up to Virginia. Michael came up to Virginia. We all had, you know, we kept in contact with these friends I made, you know, years earlier still. But that master's degree, it was a lot of work, but it was just so rewarding. And my goal after getting my master's was to basically go back to Florida and work for DEP again. And in fact, I was finishing up my master's and was looking for jobs. And I actually applied for the regional biologist position in the Panhandle, Florida, over in Panama City. No, that's only 2 hours from Wakulla. That's my stomping grounds. I love this area of the world. But then I had some friends. One of them was Charlie Baird, who I actually met at Florida State in the 90s. Him and Michael Collins are just two of the smartest people I've ever known in my life. And Charlie, we were out duck hunting one day, and I told Charlie, I said, you know, I was blessed with more brawn than brain, because at the time I was an avid power lifter, and I like to go lift heavy objects, and I always felt like I was stronger than I was smart. And Charlie goes, yeah, well, you know what you should do? You should go out and push yourself as hard as you can and see what you're capable of. And I always thank Charlie for, like, who's somebody I thought was incredibly intelligent. And he's actually a full professor now at the University of Florida, has had a great career. But he, you know, as a graduate student, as an older graduate student in his mid-30s, told me, like, you can do this. Go push yourself. Go do it. So I started also looking at PhD programs, one at UCF and also one out in New Mexico with Tom Turner. And I came across Tom Turner's name because friends, oh, this is such a small world. At Florida State, I knew people in the Joe Travis lab, like Lisa Horth and Charlie Baer. Lisa's the one that got me to move up to Virginia in the first place. She's like, you got to go to graduate school. And I always thank her so much for pushing me out the door, basically, in North Florida and encouraging me to do that. And then both her, Charlie, and Michael encouraging me to go get my PhD and, like, just full-heartedly, like, yes, you can do this. And so they were, Lisa and Charlie were in Joe Travis's lab at Florida State. Joe Travis had a graduate student named Joel Trexler, who had a graduate student named Tom Turner. And they're like, Charlie knew Tom and Lisa knew Tom. And Charlie had done some field work with Tom and thought that he was, like, a really good guy, like, really liked him. And I had realized at this point, like, you know, the questions and where I go exactly for my PhD isn't as important. What I studied was not as important to me as who I worked with. That to me was the important thing, because when I went for a PhD, I knew that I was going to have a 5-year relationship or more even. Most PhDs take longer than 5 years with my major advisor. And I wanted somebody who was good and was good with students. And they recommended that I reach out to Tom Turner. So I reached out to Tom Turner, dropped their names, and applied to University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. So Tom took me on, and I moved, and I landed in Albuquerque December 31st, 2003, spent the night here by myself on New Year's Eve. It was off, and I got like a Del Taco or something across the street. But it was interesting times. And I came out here to New Mexico, and I was going to study streams. Didn't know exactly what I was going to study. And Tom had some ideas of working overseas, and that didn't work out. So I ended up working on the Rio Grande River. And one of the things about the river is it's like this highly, highly impacted river, right? And he goes, you know, I need to know what's going on with the bugs in that river. And the one thing that I really liked about Tom, there's actually lots of things I like about Tom Turner and my master's advisor, Dave Carr. Oh, I've just been so fortunate here. But Tom really, like, go figure it out. Go. I need to know what's going on with the bugs. What's going on with the bugs in the river? Because the fish eat the bugs. And he's a, you know, he was very interested in the silvery minnow, which is an endangered species. What are these things eating? And I knew nothing of the Rio Grande. So I just went out and just started sampling. And I met at that time some lifelong friends that I have today. But Allison Pease was his master's student. She's actually now full faculty herself. She took me out and showed me the ropes of where to go collecting bugs. And then I also worked for ACER. And ACER stands for American Southwest Ichthyological Research. So I started going out with those guys monthly, sampling the middle Rio Grande River. That's from like Cochiti, which is about an hour and a half or so. No, about 30 minutes north of Albuquerque, almost all the way down to Elephant Butte, which is an hour and a half or so south of Albuquerque. And that stretch of the Rio Grande River between Cochiti and Elephant Butte is known as the Middle Rio Grande. And that is like the one place that these silvery minnows live. So I was out sampling, and then I just started collecting insects. I didn't know anything about this river. I came from Florida. I knew about these beautiful spring-fed rivers. Here's this muddy river that people siphoned off all the water from to grow alfalfa. They drove the river dry every year. And I was like, I just could not get over that. And it took me, honestly, a long time to make a connection to the Rio Grande, or especially the middle Rio Grande, because to me, people owning water, just that's just not right. Like, how can you own water and take water out of a river and let it go dry? But that's what happens out here. So at any rate, I realized that, you know, that obviously has an impact on it, but the river's dammed for all kinds of reasons. There's lots of dams on the Rio Grande to control flooding, because downtown Albuquerque has flooded in the past very badly. And then in areas or times when there's more drought, you need to capture some of that snowfall and then release it slowly so the farmers have water to do their farming and that we can send water down to Texas. So at any rate, I still wasn't really coming up with good questions on the Rio Grande. I knew that there was something about dams, and I wanted to understand how dams are working and how they were affecting the fish and how they were affecting these insects. Well, as a photographer, I had picked up photography in the late 90s, unfortunately, right after I got back from Arizona. I did take a bunch of pictures in Arizona, but it was after that I really picked up the bug when I was working at Tall Timbers. And by this time, in 2005, I had been here a year, and I had gotten a digital camera. This was a game changer. It was a Nikon D70, which I didn't have for very long because I quickly upgraded to the D200 and then the D300 after that. But I could go out and just take lots of photos and come back. And, you know, I was into natural history. I liked everything, right? And I was really getting into bugs. And I started IDing all of these insects that I took along the edge of the Rio Grande River. And I'll never forget, it's an area called Station 500. And imagine the river's flowing straight, that makes a hard right-hand turn to the west, and then makes a second hard left-hand turn to the south. And it creates a sandbank. And I was on that sandbank taking pictures of insects and spiders. And I get back and I start IDing them, and it's like, wait a second, hold on. Almost every single insect or arthropod I'm photographing is a predator. A predator. Now, wait a second. Now, hold on. Now, this doesn't make sense, right? Because in ecology, we know pretty well about nutrient flows. That, you know, herbivores or plants are common. Herbivores are less common. Predators are even more rare because the average energy transfer up a trophic feeding levels is about 10%. So that means predators are rare, yet over 70% of everything I took a picture of was a predator. Something was happening. And I started realizing, wait a second, these predators are lined up along the edge of the river and they're nailing, they're catching all of these aquatic insects that have a larval life stage in the water. And then when they become an adult, they emerge, right? And then they emerge, and then these insects, these spiders and toad bugs and things, tiger beetles would catch these things as they were emerging. They're getting subsidized. They're getting subsidized by algae. Ultimately, aquatic production is subsidizing this community. And then in areas where the river is near these dams or even downstream of the dams, because dams reduce high flows, what it does is it channelizes the river. It keeps it confined so the river doesn't flood out into the bosque like it used to. And it reduces those sandbanks. There's not a lot of like areas. It's just a big ditch. And what I discovered in my PhD was a couple of things. One, in areas that are highly channelized, that unique community is called an ecotone. This is the transition between the aquatic and the terrestrial environment. The diversity is much lower there. You just don't find as many species or insects at all. I said, oh, lots of pitfall traps doing this, right? And collected a lot of aquatics. I spent hours in the museum, like going through specimens and IDing them. And yeah, that was tough, right? Lots of hours in museum studying, figuring out how to ID insects. But that's the thing, is that this channelization, this reduction in the river flow, channelized the river. It basically lowered this diversity. And the reason why it did that, not only did they lose the habitat, but in areas where the Rio Grande was less channelized, you had this flux, this input of nutrients and energy from algae production inside the river that supported that ecotone. And in fact, there's even a reciprocal flow, because in the fall, you get leaf fall into the river, and that provides nutrients and energy. And in the summertime, algae production ramps up, and that subsidizes the terrestrial communities. So you get this reciprocal flows in rivers. So these ecosystems are intricately connected. Now, to test that even further, I did some isotope work, and I ground up some insects and burned them and looked at their carbon-12 to carbon-13 ratio, because it gets different based on if you're aquatic or terrestrial production, and the nitrogen is affected by your trophic level. And I plotted this out, and they say in science that's strange is the most important, but also the eureka is important as well. And what we discovered was that when we looked at the isotopic niche space, the carbon and nitrogen, we discovered, with Tom Turner, that most of those insects were being heavily subsidized by algae production, and that channelization of the river from dams severed that connection, which resulted in a loss of that unique community. And each of those species had its own unique isotopic niche space. And we've always heard in ecology that each species has its own unique niche, not niche. It is not French. It is not a nest. It is a niche, which is a little place you put something into. That's the origin of the word niche in ecology. Yeah, so every species has its own niche. And when we plotted this out and carbon and nitrogen, which gives us an idea of their trophic level and of the source of carbon where it's coming from, they all plotted out independently. So that was a thrust of my PhD. Now, as a side note, when I came here to do my PhD, I got into the IGRT program to study streams. And one of the classes I had to take was climate dynamics. Oh God, I did not want to take another climate class, because at University of Virginia, I took micrometeorology. First day of class, partial differential equations on fluid dynamics. That was the hardest class I've ever taken in my life, even harder than my engineering classes. Part of it is I had been out of engineering for a few years, but I was only 6 years out. That class was hard, so I did not want to take another class on meteorology. But this climate dynamics class was taught by Dave Guzler, who studies the Southwest monsoon. It is one of the best classes I ever took in my life. Like Fran James's higher vertebrates and her conservation biology class, Dave Guzler's class on climate dynamics is also one of my favorites. And because as a graduate student, I had to do this extra term paper. And I was like, oh God, why do I have to do extra work as a graduate student? But it turned out that I wrote this paper. I was talking about Gila trout, and I was worried about Gila trout and climate change. And I was wondering how climate change was going to affect them because they can't really go anywhere except further up the mountains in the Gila. And the Gila wilderness is southwest of Albuquerque. So what we did is we took a model from Ruby Leung's group that Dave knew, and this is Dave Guzler. And we were able to make predictions about the Gila trout based on the predictions of climate change. And we've discovered that, you know, they were going to be pushed up the mountains into smaller and smaller habitat during the summertime, because Gila trout, if you get above 25 degrees Celsius, they'll start dying within a few hours. They don't adapt to warmer temperatures. So we could look at like the climate change and then model that over the Gila wilderness and look at the elevations of the streams and realize they're going to be limited to very small areas during the summertime. And the other big threat because of warmer temperatures is fire. Well, that we published that paper in 2009, and all the fire predictions happened like within 6 or 7 years later. We had some of the biggest forest fires in the state's history really impacted the Gila trout very early on. So that is one of my more cited papers, is my term paper for climate dynamics. And I remember that was pretty contentious at the time. And also, while I was doing my PhD, I realized that out here, water law, the idea of who got there first is the senior water rights owner. And that was based on these mining laws. Not growing up out here, growing up in Florida, it just never worked with me very well about people siphoning water off to grow alfalfa for cattle. I had a real hard time with that. I still do, actually. I'm not against farming because we need food. And I learned that in my, you know, over the years, we need food, but we don't need to be raising cattle in drought-stricken areas. And we shouldn't be taking water out of the river just to grow alfalfa and corn for cattle. That's my opinion. People can disagree with me. I'm not against eating beef. I'm not against, you know, any of that. There are places to do it and places not to do it. In the Rio Grande Valley, to me, siphoning the water off was just not there. So as you can imagine, there's a lot of friction. I think a lot of people out here have a different relationship with the rivers than they do where I came from in Florida. In Florida, you don't really own the water. You can take your boat up a river, you can go fishing on it, and some people go tubing on it and kayaking. And so it's owned by everybody. But out here, the water is owned by people that is removed. And in fact, it goes even worse than that. If you don't use your water allotment, you can actually lose your water rights. So people are kind of forced into using it. And, you know, when the river goes dry, a lot of people like to drive their four-wheelers up and down the riverbed, right? Oh, wow, we can drive up and down this riverbed now. So there's not the recreational value that a lot of people have in Florida. Like, Florida rivers are a big thing. Out here, they're a big thing, but the use is somewhat different. To them, leaving water in the river for a fish is like, well, we got to grow alfalfa and we got to grow our crops and we got to feed cattle and horses. And why would we do that? You know? So as you can imagine, because of the Rio Grande silvery minnow was an endangered species, they were forced to like manage the river for these fish as well. So there's a lot of friction out here. So in my PhD, I was slowly realizing I didn't want to be constantly stressed about trying to save things and getting in arguments with people or trying to change people's minds about stuff. And I realized in both my master's and in my PhD that I really liked being a teacher's assistant, a TA. I liked teaching. I liked interacting with students. And by the time I finished my PhD, I remember in my defense, you know, Tom Turner goes, Tom, if you had $1 million, how would you fix the Rio Grande River? And I was just like, yeah, that's not going to do much. You got to go to Congress, buy some good lobbyists, and have them remove the dams. That's about the only way you're going to do that. And, you know, now I'm like, yeah, that's one way, but we actually need to have flood control because you don't want to flood out Albuquerque. And if you have a really good snowpack year, you might want to capture some of that water to have drinking water later on, right? So my views of this are a little bit more nuanced than they were back then, but I knew that I didn't want to go into conservation anymore. I didn't want to go into primary research. And Tom Turner was like, you know, you're going to be an expert on the Rio Grande. I'm like, I'm kind of walking away. I'm going to go into teaching. My mom was a teacher. She was a high school chemistry and did some biology, environmental science, marine biology teacher. I actually had her. She was more popular in high school than I was. I was not very popular in high school at all. But I started realizing in my PhD that I really enjoyed teaching and I enjoy doing field work to this day. And in fact, in January of 2024, I was in Colombia with Steve Poe collecting sleep data and taking photos of anoles for some of his research. And also during my PhD and my master's, I also would help out my fellow graduate students with their work. So in the summer of 2007 and 2008, I worked for Blair Wolf, who's an ecophysiologist, and he's very interested in climate change. And he studies desert birds and desert animals. And his thing is, you know, these animals are living at the cusp. They're living at the edge when it gets really hot. And he was interested in, like, if you have a 2-degree warming on top of a heat wave, what does that do? What are these physiological limits of these birds and lizards? So if you knew the physiological limits, like, okay, you can survive 120 degrees, but 122, you die even if you have water and in the shade, then he could map out, like, what's going to happen to bird populations and lizard populations based on climate change. And, you know, in Australia, they get these horrible heat waves that just kill budgerigars by the hundreds of thousands. So I went and worked with his graduate student, Teresa Hyde. I was her assistant in the summertime. Blair paid me, so I didn't have to TA, to go collect all these birds out of the mist nets. And he was also interested if the birds were actually using any of the water wells that the Arizona Game and Fish put out. And then in my master's, I had a friend named Joe Crossell who was very interested in how changes in pH from acid rain might affect different types of fish in the mountain streams of the Shenandoahs. So we would go to all these beautiful mountain streams and electroshock the fish to see what they're there. And then we did these experiments, these crossing over experiments to see how well they handled different streams with different chemistries. And my brother was at the time, he came up and I said, all right, DJ, we got to do some work here. He goes, you know, I didn't really come up to see to go do work. I said, don't worry, you'll like this. And I take him up to like this most beautiful mountain stream in the early spring. Things are just leafing out. We walk up these streams and we're catching fish. And DJ's like, this is work. And I'm like, yep. And I also did a lot of work with my friend Wade Wilson, who is also a fellow lab mate in the Turner Lab. Wade is now like the regional, well, actually he was a regional geneticist down at Dexter. Now he's in charge of Dexter. And we would travel all over the mountains of northern New Mexico, southern Colorado, collecting trout to get fin clips to do genetic analysis on the populations of these things. And while we were there, he was interested in parasites, so we also looked at some of the parasite loads of those fish as well. Ironically, during my PhD, I'm working down in the desert with Blair Wolf and his graduate student, Teresa Hyde, who she was amazing. You know, I mean, just one of the most fun people I've ever worked with in my life doing desert ecophysiology. And then in the spring and fall, on top of doing my own research, I'm going up to all the mountains of northern New Mexico and southern Colorado collecting all the Rio Grande cutthroat and other types of cutthroat trout. So yeah, at one point I knew all the trout were in New Mexico, but I never told anybody what all we caught. That was a lot of fun. So yeah, that was my graduate school days, right? And I knew during that time that I still loved the field work, loved being in science, but I was going to go teach. And in 2009, I was getting ready to graduate. And man, I knew that it was coming to an end. Like this golden era of my graduate school is coming to an end. And if anybody recognizes the time period of 2009, you'll know that that's like the Great Recession hit, right? When like nobody had a job. So I applied for just job after job after job. Well, after a few rejection letters and whatnot, you know, our emeritus curator of the fish division, Steve Ross, said, let me see your cover letter. And he went in there and wordsmithed it a little bit. And after he wordsmithed it, I got actually three callbacks and I ended up taking a job up in Cartersville, Georgia, in the small community college. I was going to take anything. And I actually really liked that job, but I was only there for two semesters. Land of entrapment. New Mexico called me back, and I flew myself back for two interviews with Central New Mexico Community College, CNM, and I got my job there. I mean, I talked them into it. I said, look, I'm not here for a raise. I want to be back in New Mexico. And they hired me, which is awesome. I was so happy to be moving back to New Mexico. And then I was there for 5 years. And I really enjoyed working at Central New Mexico Community College. They had great students. The faculty was amazing. I worked with such great people. But then I had an opportunity to go back to UNM as a lecturer over there, and I jumped at it, even with a pay cut. And part of that was I taught fewer classes. They were bigger classes, but I was back on the university with some of my best friends, and I was back in that research culture again. I was going back to lab meetings, you know, with Steve. Ever since I've been back, we've been on 7 trips or so to the tropics collecting lizards. You know, I'm back going to lab meetings, both at the Turner Lab in the beginning. Now I've been going to Steve Poe's lab, and now I'm in Kelly Miller's, going back to these meetings. And I really enjoy the academic environment of being at an R1. I also really like the students, and I love teaching. And ironically, having a lesser teaching load, I ended up working harder because now I spend way more time rather than just grading papers than I was at the other place at CNM. Now I spend a lot of time generating content for my students and keeping up with the latest science and actually developing a new class like astrobiology. So in some of my classes, and they don't have to buy a textbook. I just give it to them, the writing. And I do the Tom Kennedy Science, which is my YouTube channel. I do YouTube videos for my lectures, and then also have a chance to do the podcast like that now. And I know going from 2009 to 2024, that's 15 years, but I've really been at UNM now for 10 years, and I still thoroughly enjoy it. And, you know, I've got some great friends there. I have some great colleagues. I have met some of the most amazing students, both at CNM in my first, you know, few years of teaching, and also at UNM. And to all you Gen Zers out there, Gen Alphas and Millennials that I've interacted with, you know, there's a lot of concern about you guys, especially the Gen Zers. Man, you guys rock, actually. You're going to change the work culture where, you know, we don't have to work 5 days a week slaving all the time. I really appreciate it. And some of the students, the best students I've had have been in the last few years, even after COVID. It's been awesome. All right. Well, that's my journey, and I hope you enjoyed it. And stay tuned for the next episode of Tom SciCast.